In obedience to a sign from Ahab, Starbuck was now pulling obliquely across Stubb's bow. And when for a minute or so the two boats were pretty near to each other, Stubb hailed the mate. "Mr. Starbuck, larboard boat there, ahoy, a word with you, sir, if you please." "Hello," returned Starbuck, turning round not a single inch as he spoke, still earnestly but whisperingly urging his crew, his face set like a flint from Stubbs. "What think you of those yellow boys, sir?" "Smuggled on board somehow before the ship sailed." "Strong, strong boys," in a whisper to his crew, then speaking out loud again. "A sad business, Mr. Stubb. See there, my lads. But never mind, Mr. Stubb, all for the best. Let all your crew pull strong, come what will. Spring, my men, spring. There's hogsheads of sperm ahead, Mr. Stubb, and that's what you came for. Pull, my boys. Sperm, sperm's the play. This, at least, is duty, duty and profit, hand in hand."
Aye, I thought as much," soliloquized Stubb, when the boats diverged. "As soon as I clapped eye on him, I thought so. Aye, and that's what he went into the afterhold for, so often as Doughboy long suspected. They were hidden down there. The white whale's at the bottom of it. Well, well, so be it, can't be helped. All right, give way, men, it ain't the white whale today, give way."
Now the advent of these outlandish strangers at such a critical instant as the lowering of the boats from the deck, this had not unreasonably awakened a sort of superstitious amazement in some of the ship's company. But Archie's fancied discovery having some time previous got abroad among them, though indeed not credited then, this had in some small measure prepared them for the event. It took off the extreme edge of their wonder. And so what with all this, and Stubb's confident way of accounting for their appearance, they were for the time freed from superstitious surmisings, though the affair still left abundant room for all manner of wild conjectures as to dark Ahab's precise agency in the matter from the beginning. For me, I silently recalled the mysterious shadows I had seen creeping on board the Pequod during the dim Nantucket dawn, as well as the enigmatical hintings of the unaccountable Elijah. Meantime, Ahab, out of hearing of his officers, having sighted the furthest to windward, was still ranging ahead of the other boats, a circumstance bespeaking how potent a crew was pulling him. Those tiger-yellow creatures of his seemed all steel and whalebone. Like five trip-hammers, they rose and fell with regular strokes of strength, which periodically started the boat along the water like a horizontal burst boiler out of a Mississippi steamer. As for Fadala, who was seen pulling the harpooner oar, he had thrown aside his black jacket and displayed his naked chest with the whole part of his body above the gunwale, clearly cut against the alternating depressions of the watery horizon, while at the other end of the boat, Ahab, with one arm like a fencer's thrown half backward into the air as if to counterbalance any tendency to trip, Ahab was seen steadily managing his steering oar, as in a thousand boat lowerings ere the white whale had torn him. All at once, the outstretched arm gave a peculiar motion and then remained fixed, while the boat's five oars were seen simultaneously peaked. Boat and crew sat motionless on the sea. Instantly, the three spread boats in the rear paused on their way. The whales had irregularly settled bodily down into the blue, thus giving no distantly discernible token of the movement, though from his closer vicinity Ahab had observed it.
"Every man, look out along his oar!" cried Starbuck. "Thou, Queequeg, stand up!"
Nimbly springing up on the triangular raised box in the bow, the savage stood erect there, and with intensely eager eyes gazed off towards the spot where the chase had last been descried. Likewise, upon the extreme stern of the boat, where it was also triangularly platformed, level with the gunwale, Starbuck himself was seen coolly and adroitly balancing himself to the jerking tossings of his chip of a craft, and silently eyeing the vast blue eye of the sea. Not very far distant, Flask's boat was also lying breathlessly still, its commander recklessly standing upon the top of the loggerhead, a stout sort of post rooted in the keel and rising some 2 feet above the level of the stern platform. It is used for catching turns with the whale line. Its top is not more spacious than the palm of a man's hand, and standing upon such a base as that, Flask seemed perched at the masthead of some ship which had sunk to all but her trucks. But Little Kingpost was small and short, and at the same time Little Kingpost was full of a large and tall ambition, so that this loggerhead standpoint of his did by no means satisfy Kingpost.
"I can't see 3 seas off. Tip us up an oar there, and let me on to that."
Upon this, Daggoo, with either hand upon the gunwale to steady his way, swiftly slid aft, and then erecting himself, volunteered his lofty shoulders for a pedestal.
"Good masthead as any, sir. Will you mount?"
"That I will, and thank you very much, my fine fellow. Only I wish you 50 feet taller."
Whereupon, planting his feet firmly against two opposite planks of the boat, the gigantic negro, stooping a little, presented his flat palm to Flask's foot, and then putting Flask's hand on his hearse-plumed head and bidding him spring as he himself should toss, with one dexterous fling landed the little man high and dry on his shoulders. And here was Flask now standing, Daggoo with one lifted arm furnishing him with a breastband to lean against and steady himself by.
This ends Disc 7.